a dim bone, dim bone, dim drive.
Welcome to MRCS on the Move. Bowels, bones, and backseat drivers. I'm your host, Naomi, but this is the podcast where you do the talking. Hello, welcome to our second instalment of medical statistics on bowels, bones, and backseat drivers. I'm happy to welcome back Tim, my father, and our specialist statistician. I didn't tell you last time, but he is known to his colleagues in the statistical world as the stat in the hat, as he is never seen without a flat cap on. He's quite proud of this, I think, aren't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so last episode, essentially we covered the types of data, the types of study and the hierarchy of evidence, and just at the end touched a little bit on sort of incidence and prevalence, didn't we? Mm-hmm. So this time we're going to talk about the different types of data that we come across, and then we're going to dive into some definitions. So to start with, tell me what different types of data you are aware of.
Okay, so if you want it, it's 2x2, like the arc. So there's qualitative data, and I guess qualitative data is where you're putting the data into categories. If the categories have got no order at all, then that's called nominal data. So you might, for example, colour, although we could argue has got an order to it, but colour, for example, might be a nominal one, or types of fruit would be a different type of nominal data. And then if there is some sort of order in that qualitative data, then it's called ordinal data. So a rating scale would be ordinal scale, or you might, the one I've come across is the where you talk about pain being on a scale of 1 to 10, that would be an ordinal qualitative piece of data.
Mm-hmm. So then the second?
Oh, of course, thank you. I can't count. Mm-hmm. So that's the first two of the two. Okay, and the second of the two is quantitative or metric. And that's where you've got two different options. One we call discrete, the other continuous. The discrete, of course, is where you can count them. So you might, let's think of an example. You might, I guess, crudely you count heartbeats. That's one group where another is continuous, where you're measuring something using an instrument. So that might be blood pressure or concentration of a chemical in urine, for example, that would be continuous. And the one of the things to remember about these is that there's an order to the different types of data, in that continuous data can always be binned into discrete groups, so you can count the number of times that a continuous variable falls into a discrete. Discrete data, because it goes one up to whatever, always has an order, so discrete data always fits within ordinal data. And ordinal data, given that it is in categories, can be cast as continuous because it's still a group. So there's a hierarchy, if you like, of numbers, and you can always treat the lower level numbers as if they are a higher one. You just lose some of the discrimination in the data, which makes it sometimes harder to prove something. What is dangerous, though, is if you go the other way around, and if you try and, for example, pretend that a nominal data has some, or impose an order on it, or if you try and number, a common thing is to number ordered data as if it's number 1 to 5, say. It happens often in a Likert scale, and so you might generate an average order, which is, if we ever get around to talking about tests, is actually a common thing that your hat does in non-parametric tests, which I always think
causes a problem, but something to be aware of. And again, if you treat discrete data as continuous, you're implying things about the distance between the numbers that are not necessarily the case. So one way up, going up the route is really good and perfectly okay, but going down the way has a whole bunch of dangers with it.
Okay. So we're going to move on to some definitions and things that relate to significance testing, our aims or hypotheses of studies and how we then prove them either right or wrong, or try to. I see you grinning because I know how you feel about these things, but we'll pretend you love p-values, Dad, for one moment, please. Okay. So first question, hopefully a simple one for most, what is a null hypothesis?
Okay, so this is where some people think it goes into the really dull bit of statistics, but this is where I think actually it relates back to the exciting thing, is about how we're going to induce things about the process. And the null hypothesis is the statement that we're not, if we're going to look at just a two category environment, we're going to say that there's just no difference going to occur. So in the past, there's no difference between this group, and we're saying that in the future, there's no difference in the group, and nothing has changed, and that's our null hypothesis.
So no difference will be found between two populations.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay,
so what is an alternative hypothesis then?
Okay, so the alternative hypothesis is that actually there is a difference between the two populations that we're considering, and that this difference hasn't occurred by chance or random or chaotic variations that are nothing to do with the hypothesis.
Okay, then so that brings us on to p-values. So what is a p-value? And what are we generally willing to accept?
Well, this is where you have to be very careful about how you actually operate things, rather than... So, for example, what you find is that some people set up in the beginning some rather unambitious null hypotheses, those null hypotheses are almost certainly going to be changed if you're not careful. So people like for example, if there's a trend going on, but you say, okay, no trend's happening, where you know they've seen a trend before, and then you're almost certainly going to create a trend. You then assign that to the thing that you are really interested in. So you've got to be really careful that your alternative hypothesis and your null hypothesis are relevant to distinguishing the effect you're really interested in, not just any effect, because we're trying to assign that, because that's really important to how you understand the p-value. So the p-values are all really connected with the mathematics of probability underneath, which is why I get quite worried about how some people use it, because they haven't been taught probability theory underneath. But without rumbling along about that too much, what we basically say is the p-value is what's the likelihood or the probability that you would see the final outcome in the data if the null hypothesis, i.e. that there was no difference between the data, is true. And this is where this logical incompatibility occurs, in that if there is no difference between two populations, how can there then be a difference and it still be true? And that's because when we say there's no difference, we're saying there's no difference other than random or uncontrolled changes. So once there's random and uncontrolled changes, things can vary, and if you only do things a few times, things can vary quite a lot, and you need to be comfortable that they're there's changes within that normal, I shouldn't use that word normal in this context because it could confuse, within the typical behaviours. If we get a very low p-value, and typically it's if the p-value is below 0.05, but that's purely a convention. A guy, an early statistician called Fisher, just decided that if something happens only one in 20 times, then that's, we're going to call that unusual, or what gets called significant. And that it just stuck as a rule of thumb. So typically a journal will look for the fact that you've created a p-value below 0.05. As I say, you can create p-values below 0.05 just by generating a silly null hypothesis.
Okay, we're going to move on because I know how much you can ramble about p-values.
Yeah.
I have to say it is rather helpful having a dad as a statistician when it comes to our annual audits and stuff that we have to do, but perhaps don't tell any of my consultants that. maybe I should take that bit out. So moving on now to how we define our data or some of the results that we come up with. So this is going to be quite a few just simple definitions. So starting off with mode, mean and median. So I'll give you quite a bit of time now, just see if you can go through what you think each of them are and how they're different. So go.
Okay, so the first definitions are about what happens typically. So what would you say is the most common behavior? And there's three different ways to, typical ways to assess that. They are actually directly related to the different types of data too. So the first one and the thing that you can use most generally is the mode, which is just the most common category, which can often be quite useful. But what's important to know about a mode is what proportion of the data does that mode then represent, because it could actually be really a small number, could be quite large. So mode is the first one.
Rather, and that's used in which type of data?
Or categorical data. So you can use that for any data.
Okay.
The mode. The second one you need to think about is the median. And the median, because the median data, the reason it's second is because that can be applied to ordinal data, because you have to have for the ordinal data an order. And once you order that data, you find out what data, where it sits in the middle. It's particularly useful for ranked information. And then the third one is the mean, which is the one that's, if you like, the default when people get asked what the average is, and the average or the mean is where you add up the data. So it has to be on discrete, or it has to be on quantitative data, so discrete or continuous data. You add all that data up and you divide by the number of times you've seen that bit of data, and that generates the mean, which is it's the value which, if every record you had the same value, would have the same effect. And one of the problems with the average is it's easy to calculate but quite easy to misunderstand, and so I get quite irritated when I hear things like I heard this morning that every 5 minutes a man dies of prostate cancer, I think it was. That's not what an average tells you, because it won't be every 5 minutes. In fact, it will happen in spurts. And if it is random data, it will happen. There'll be gaps when there's none, and there'll be others when there's lots. And that's not because of time of day, because of course time of day will almost certainly impact on those sorts of things. So an average does not mean that every once in every 5 minutes someone died, but that's nearly always how it's quoted, and I throw things at the radio or whatever when people make that statement. But
okay,
Okay.
But the other thing to remember is that actually averages are also, they're very susceptible to single unusual values. So they're unrobust.
What's it when it's really far out of range?
An outlier. Outliers can affect an average quite dramatically. So you might end up quoting an average which is really representing just a single number in the data set. Almost the opposite of a mode, which is why it's quite often a good idea to use what's called clipped averages, where you knock out the maximum and the minimum number, or the maximum and minimum twice. This method is used, for example, when you're judging diving or gymnastics at the Olympics to try and get away from judges' bias. You ignore the highest and the lowest mark, and you get the
oh, that's what they do when they knock them all off. There you go. Applied to everything, isn't it?
Indeed. That's what I told you. Statistics is fascinating.
Okay. I wasn't expecting that long an answer on the mode meaning. Mine's about 3 lines. So then we'll move on from that. We'll talk about the spread of data. Mm-hmm. So this will cover things like the range, standard deviation, standard error, and confidence interval. So again, give you a bit of a moment, see if you can think of what the definitions are.
Okie doke. So again, this set of data or way of summarizing data is intimately connected to the types of data that you've got. And what this is really trying to give you a handle on is, whereas the first one told you what was commonly occurred, what was a typical value, and if I was going to put a single number in, what would I choose as my representation, even if I didn't say it was 1 every 5 minutes or something. But anyway, it says, how reliable is that common number? So if I say my average is 3 and my range of some sort is from 2 to 4, then I know that actually that 3 is reasonably useful. But if it turns out that my range is from 0 to 20, then using my typical value of 3 is going to be somewhat questionable when I make some assessments. So the first definition is the range, and the range just takes the maximum and the minimum value for the data that I've managed. The real difficulty with that particular assessment is that it depends a lot on quite how many records you've valued. Somewhat like the fact that at the moment the temperature in the our range of temperatures keeps on going up because we're measuring weather much more often as time goes on. Standard deviation then is where you look at the difference between the mean value that you've assessed, and usually that is the mean and the average, but sometimes it could be the median. So you take your typical value that you're going to use, and you look at how far from that typical value the number you are looking at is. And then once you've got that difference, you can then do a variety of different things. The usual thing is to square that difference and then take the square root. That gets rid of the fact that if you add them together, you've got lots of plus and minuses that you don't want to cancel out. But you can just take the absolute value between so you just say, you just knock off the plus and minus sign, and that can be a very good measure of range. In some ways it's my preferred one, and the reason it is that, again, as I mentioned with average, some values can be very susceptible to individual outliers that can cause the data to go a long way out, and the square makes it very susceptible. So you've got the range and the standard deviation, which are the summaries of the data itself. But then you can then think about, okay, how much do my actual summaries vary? So the first two, the range and the standard deviation, we're looking at how far apart does the data itself spread. But then I want to know, okay, how much does my measure of location, my mean, move around itself if I take multiple different samples? And that's called the standard error. And based on the standard error, then the confidence interval. Well, I'll come to the confidence interval later. So the standard error is typically the standard deviation divided by the square root of the number of people, things in the sample. And the the confidence interval then relates to a whole other area of statistics called distributions, which is where you look at the way my daughter is now putting her head in her hands, because I could talk for hours about distributions, but
I'm just slightly aware of the length of our normal podcast. That's all.
But suffice to say that the one you'll usually get brought to is a thing called the normal distribution, the bell curve, which is in a lot of statistics, particularly about humans, is not as normal as the name suggests. But in measurements of human physiology, the normal distribution can be quite common. So the important thing is that if you calculate a number called the Z score, you may come across the Z score. The Z score is where you take the value that you're interested in, you subtract from it the mean, and you divide that difference by the standard deviation. You then get the Z score. And that means that you can relate all your data to a single normal distribution. And that single normal distribution has an average of zero, so it's centered around the zero on the number line, and it has a standard deviation of one. And that's when you can start to make some useful assessments and typically how people calculate their p-values. Because I know, for example, if it really is a normal distribution, that 67% of the data lies within one standard deviation. So you're twice as likely to be nearer to the average than you are further away than a standard deviation. And two standard deviations gives you roughly 95%. So a confidence interval, so where you've got a p-value of 0.05, you're within two standard deviations of the average. And that's where nearly everybody tries to get their p-values from. You can also draw that out, and this is where you get a confidence interval. If you draw out the values between two standard deviations and the mean, you have a confidence interval. And if you plot those on charts, you can get a quite quick visual assessment of whether two populations are significantly different if their confidence intervals don't overlap.
Okay.
So, but as I say, all that has a whole bunch of assumptions floating around underneath it, which people forget, which is why people like me get grumpy.
You get paid to do your statistics, though. Most of us don't.
Oh, that makes it all right then.
No, I'm just saying you might have more time to give to it.
Well, I know, absolutely.
Okay, so I am very aware of the time, so I apologise this is a slightly longer episode than normal, but I think we'll just crack on through some final bits. Pardon?
This is a whole other podcast altogether.
Do you want to do another podcast?
Yeah.
Okay, so I've been overruled by my special guest, unsurprisingly, because he's my father. We will do a third unplanned episode on essentially this one is looking at sensitivity, specificity, positive predictive values.
Contingency tables.
Contingency tables. There we go. And we will eventually talk about bias at some point.
Oh, absolutely. That's a whole other podcast.
Okay. Well, there we go. It's going to be the longest series I've ever done. Thank you very much, and we will be back with you shortly. Ta-ta.
will a dim bone, dim bone, dim dry bone.